Hi, everybody. We want to thank our sponsor, Legion M. They are a wonderful company. We love working with them. You can go to their website, Legion M. They're also on all the various socials. They do really fun meetups. You can talk to directors. You can become a part of the projects they choose. They even have a program right now where you can help them find great movies to support. So go to their website to learn more. We also want to remind you that we have a Patreon that we call Maltreon. You can join us. We have $3, $5, $10, $20 options. You can get newsletters from my dad, all kinds of neat stuff behind the scenes. Hang out with us, learn about who our guests are before anybody else, and listen to the podcast before anybody else. Go to patreon.com/maltononmovies for more information.
That's patreon.com/maltononmovies. Hi, I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
And you're listening to Maltin on Movies, and it is our great pleasure to have as our guest today, Danny Houston.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's a treat to have you here because we're fans. We are unabashed fans. We've said that before, but we tend to have people on this show that we really admire, and you are one of them. And you've done such extraordinary work as an actor. I just asked you off mic because I didn't want to embarrass myself by not knowing if you ever had formal training as an actor, and you said no.
No, I actually haven't. I had the great luxury and privilege to observe wonderful actors at work, peering over my father's shoulder.
Father's formidable shoulder. Your formidable father's formidable
large
shoulder.
Yeah, actually, he's a giant. It's impossible. It's impossible to do that. I was just talking the other day about my memories of being a young kid in the Atlas Mountains in Morocco, watching my father direct Man Would Be King. Mm. And, for a kid, there were the blue people there, and Michael Caine, Sean Connery, Christopher Plummer, and it was just an exciting, adventurous, Kipling-esque time. And to see these guys at work was just an incredible treat. But also, I observed with a keen eye.
Mm-hmm. Did you always know, or was it fated that you would be in this business?
There was a sense of doom. But I saw my father at times, believe it or not, struggle. The amount of money involved to make a film, the whole sort of circus act around it. Maybe the sometimes the nonsense. So I love to paint. I like to draw, and I went to art school, and I think it was my first or second year in art school. We then went to gallery openings, and as part of the course, and I saw people drinking warm white wine, and that there was just as much nonsense around the art world, egos, etc., and how to market yourself, and so finally I relented and I went to film school.
Where?
I went to the London International Film School, and my first job as a director was for my father. He was watching this test that they did for a credit sequence for a film that he made called Under the Volcano.
Wonderful film.
Wonderful Malcolm Lowry, Albert Finney. And there were these papier-mâché dolls from Day of the Dead, and they were very static. So he was struggling to make it more exciting, how to make the shots more exciting. And I used to make him, depending on what country we were in, I'd make him a drink. When we were looking at the dailies, at the rushes. In this particular case, it was Cuba Libre, rum and coke. And I brought him his drink, and he said, no, the coke should only color the rum. and then he looked at me and he said, Danny, might you be interested in directing the title sequence? And it was, he put the fear of God in me. But of course I said yes. And he handed over Gabriel Figueroa, one of the great cinematographers of all time.
You just gave me heart
palpitations.
My dad's
on the floor. We're just going to pick him back up again.
And I shot the sequence, and much to my delight, he liked it.
And Mr. Figueroa?
Mr. Figueroa was, I said, Gabriel, because my father had just discovered a Steadicam. He said, Danny, come over here. Let me show you. Look at that. And I went, what is it? It's a Steadicam. I went, yeah, wow. He goes, yeah, I don't have to lay tracks. It's just a camera, and it's attached to the man, and I don't have to waste all that time. And it was a complicated shot. It started in a theater, and then it came out through a market and into a square with bright light. And I said to Gabriel Figueroa, I said, how do you light it? I mean, you went from darkness to light. How do you do it? And Gabriel said, it's all a question of balance. And and that's the first lesson I got from one of the great masters. It's all a question of balance. But Gabriel shot the sequence for me. I was able to get the camera in there, move around these dolls, much to my delight, he liked it.
Oh boy, how old would you have been?
I would have been in my early 20s.
Mm-hmm. What an opportunity!
Yeah,
man, oh man.
Yeah.
Remember the first film set you visited?
It probably is my understanding of fiction and reality are a little confused, in all honesty. But I like to say, if one were to use my father's films as a sort of measuring stick, that I was conceived during a film he made called Freud, and born during the Bible.
It's nice to have these things, though, to figure out
both
your life.
Them,
you know?
I may have them completely out of and teethed them on Night of the Iguana. But my first film that I saw in the editing bay being made was the Bible, and the film starts, and for all of us, I guess our parents are godlike for a while at least. Mm-hmm. but in this particular case, the film starts and I hear my father's voice, and it's in the beginning. And I'm like, oh my God, my father is God. and then the film continues and he plays Noah. Mm-hmm. And there he is walking into the ark with all these animals side by side. And I was like, wow, Dad's Noah. And then my mother turns up in the film and she's playing Hagar. And she's in the desert, dying of thirst. She's been ejected by Abraham, and she's there dying of thirst. And then she has a kid, and the kid wasn't me. So I was thoroughly confused, and I've been confused ever since.
My goodness! And just to sort of sort all of this out so that everybody understands, your bloodlines are extremely elite. I think that's the best word for it. Your grandfather was the great Walter Huston, one of the finest actors who ever trod the boards, as we say, and who won his Academy Award as Best Supporting Actor in your father's movie, The Treasure of the Sierra Madre, in a role that your father wrote specifically for him to play.
Yes.
And then your father won an Oscar that same year for making the movie. So that was the first ever father-son duo to walk away with Oscars the same evening, and rightly so.
Has that ever happened again?
I don't think.
I
don't think for the same picture.
No,
but
no,
of course, my sister Angelica won an Academy Award for Pritzi's Honor.
Pritzi's Honor, and your father, was he nominated for that?
He was nominated, but he didn't win.
Right. So they came close.
Yeah.
They came close.
But I remember my father talking about Humphrey Bogart and saying, and they were having a conversation that he told me, and he said that he and Bogie were discussing this whole award thing and how there's a sort of vulgarity to it and sort of cheapness to the having to sell yourself in that way. But then when Bogart won his Academy Award, my father said he seemed inordinately proud.
Yes, you can be flippant about it until you're a winner.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my! And your grandmother, Walter's wife, was a formidable actress herself.
Yes. Yes. And of course, my sister Angelica, and now my nephew Jack.
Yes.
Which is tremendous.
Yeah. You know,
it's family business.
It's great.
I hope that SAG gives you guys like extra credit somewhere to have that many of you in there. Maybe like a family rate discount or something like
that.
That
would be funny.
I think, I wish I could be absolutely sure, but I think I attended a press conference for Mr. North, the film that you directed from a screenplay that was sort of rewritten by your father.
Yes.
And that's, I'm looking at my year, 1988.
Wow.
And which is now 30 years ago, if we can believe that. And he was originally going to star in it, as
he
I
was.
Understand.
He was.
And then he was unable to do it.
Yeah, he called me on his way to Newport, Rhode Island, where we filmed it. And he said, Danny, if I ever were to fall ill, or if anything were to happen, I'd like to have somebody just to stand by, just in case. I said, well, I'm sure you'll be fine, but sure, if it makes you feel good. He said, I'll give Robert Mitchum a call. And so he called Robert Mitchum and had him stand by. Sadly, he did become ill and checked into the hospital in Newport, Rhode Island. And Robert Mitchum heroically turned up and said to my father, John, I'm sorry about the circumstances, but I'm here. I'm delighted to be here. And when he left the room, my father, this is an intensive care, basically. My father lowered his oxygen mask, looked at me, winked, and said, biggest hoax I ever pulled. Now, this, I think, talks about the generosity of the man, you know, the largeness of spirit, and showing that that little bravado at that point speaks volumes.
Yeah.
Well, there are so many, there are a lot of terms my dad and I are a bit annoyed by only because they're used so frequently. Icon, you know, legend. These people say it for everything, you know, but truly your family, you've got icons and legends. And it's always interesting to then hear about the human side, because especially in my house growing up with this one, you know, again, the name Houston loomed large. So to then hear stories when someone talks about something personally, hell, even just saying, so Robert Mitchum came through. That's so nice. I'm sure every kid, when they're making their first movie, has, and who else, Lauren Bacall?
Yeah, Harry Dean Stanton, David Warner, Virginia Madsen, Mary Stuart Masterson, to name a few.
And Anthony Edwards.
And Anthony Edwards in the lead role.
In the lead role.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, this has to be the dumbest, most obvious question I could ask, but were you intimidated working with these people? And if so, how did you work through that?
Well,
because you're going to direct them now in a story, and you're not doing it for a studio. You're doing it independently on a location, so there are other pressures involved as well.
Yeah, I mean the intimidation really came from my father. I mean, just as a kid growing up, if you were summoned, you would literally shake in your boots, and then everything was okay, you know. Mm-hmm. But there was that sort of moment of extreme fear, and these guys that were working on the films that I was making whilst my father was alive had such great respect for my father, and they were keen on helping me out.
Mm-hmm.
So I never really felt any power play. But
that's wonderful.
Yeah, it is. I directed my father in an hour-long film called Mr. Corbett's Ghost that I made for English television. And he played a collector of souls, typecast.
I was going to say.
And And we started, I think it was one of the first days of filming, and my father got a line wrong, and he said, cut. And I was a young buck. So I was like, Dad, you can't do that. You can't say cut. I'm the director. I'm the one who has to say. And he said, oh, I'm ever so sorry. I'll never do it again. Again, an example of his wonderful nature.
That's so lovely. Yeah. That's such a wonderful and earnest as well. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to do that, Danny. Oh, no. Oh, I love that.
Now, so how did you come to be an actor, since that was not your goal?
Well, when my father wasn't around anymore, I kind of lost my collaborator, my buddy.
Mm-hmm.
I was in L.A., and I had these projects that I was developing, and I was going on a lot of meetings, phone calls, and I was sort of in a sort of seasonless state. It's already hard to tell what the seasons are here in L.A. But I felt I was active, but years were going by, and I wasn't getting anything made. And friends, fellow directors, out of the kindness of their hearts, started giving me jobs as an actor. And I saw it as an opportunity to observe other filmmakers at work, because my experience was solely my father. People like Mike Figgis offered me waiter number two.
In Leaving Las Vegas.
In Leaving Las Vegas. And a friend of mine called Bernard Rose and I started working together as collaborators, and we adapted maybe four or five Tolstoy adaptations.
Yeah, but the first one.
Ivan's Ecstasy.
Ivan's Ecstasy. A killer. An absolute killer of a script and a killer of a role for you, and it really put you on the map.
It did, and it interested directors. The next thing I think I did was 21 Grams, and then I was working opposite Nicole Kidman, and then Scorsese. Mm-hmm. Oh wow! I better take this seriously. This seems to be working, and it's an opportunity. I always kept it as an opportunity to watch other people that I admired work. And as an actor, you can literally, you can be like a sort of like a bee, and you can go from one flower to the next and sort of taste the nectar and kind of move on as they have to edit and complete and release the film. And so you're able to gather more than just one experience every, I mean, how long does it take to make a film? 2-3 years, if you're lucky.
Yeah.
But here I was able to make three or four films per year if I was lucky.
Yeah. Now, let's talk about Ivan's Ecstasy for a moment. It's based on a real fellow, an agent. As you said, Tolstoy is the foundation for the story. But the specific of it is an agent, a very high-powered agent, who is sort of going off the deep end.
Yeah.
So again, you're not experienced as an actor. How do you approach that? And was Bernard Rose, able to unlock some doors for you, creatively speaking, to let you inhabit that character?
Right. I think Bernard Rose and I have a sort of silent understanding that is based on our passion for Tolstoy.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really primarily where the performance comes from. Now, because of our limitations, we weren't able to make a period film, and we had practically no money to make it at all. And we were very excited about this new medium called digital, and we had the Sony camera that was given to us by Sony. And our opportunity was to make this film in our backyard. So how do you do it? Well, you make it about people that maybe you know, or the environment that you understand, and start to build from there.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a little bit of a poison letter to Hollywood.
maybe more than a little bit.
But primarily, it's the study of a man's death.
Mm-hmm. It's, well, as I say, I haven't seen it actually since it was new, but it lingers in my memory because it made such a deep impression.
I believe it was a fine film, and, mm-hmm. and it was released at a particular time when the stars were aligned for us,
mm-hmm.
and for me, because it gave me this wonderful opportunity.
None of us have experienced this. What is it like to be on a set being directed by Martin Scorsese, as you were in The Aviator?
What I love about Marty is he doesn't miss a single detail. He goes, "I like the way you do that. I like the way that you did that with your ring. And and that works." And I said, "Do you think you should have a few more lines before? Or maybe you can talk a little bit afterwards." And there's a long shot. And it moves from there. And he's got that contagious sort of thing where you mm-hmm. just—he's completely youthful and excited, you can see how that's the habitat that he understands mm-hmm. and knows. And wonderful with actors, because it's nice or pleasant to hear a director comment on what it is that you're doing, rather than them just moving on to the next shot.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The care and feeding of actors is very important.
Yes.
And I gather not every director does what you just said.
No, they don't. I remember, my father cast his films so brilliantly, and he believed that the actors, in a way, knew their role more profoundly maybe mm-hmm. than he did, and that's why he cast them. So they didn't really need any direction.
Mm-hmm.
So it was rare to hear my father give anybody any direction.
I have been for decades now collecting stories about your father's terse but incredibly effective directing tips to his actors. Some of them I got firsthand from the actors, and some I've read about. But apparently on Pritzi's Honor, or he's directing your sister Angelica and Jack Nicholson, Nicholson at one point was having a little difficulty, and your father said, "Jack, he's dumb." And that's apparently all Nicholson needed to hear to understand where he was supposed to be, what he was supposed to be doing.
Yeah,
I
remember when Jack Nicholson came to visit my father in Mexico. It was a place that you can only get to by boat,
mm-hmm.
and he was reading the script, and he was reading it over and over again. And finally, he said to my father, "Look, John, I don't get it." And my father looked at him and said, "No, Jack, it's a comedy." And I go, "Oh, okay, I get it." But one of my favorite pieces of direction actually was on African Queen,
mm-hmm.
Where Katharine Hepburn was struggling with the role slightly. And she spoke to my father and said, I'm having trouble. I don't quite know how to portray this character." And he paused and said, "Eleanor Roosevelt." And that's all she needed.
Yeah.
That was the key into the character. And that's what he was brilliant at.
Yes, he certainly was.
Was the economy
of
direction. And just giving the actor the key into the character so you can unlock mm-hmm. the box and mm-hmm. you know what you're doing.
Now, you've also worked with some of today's brightest lights. I'm thinking of, you mentioned 21 Grams. Alejandro González Iñárritu is right at the top of the heap.
Yeah.
And
we saw he and Guillermo del Toro did a Q&A at the Telluride Film Festival for Shape of Water, where they didn't talk about the film at all. They just complimented each other back and forth. And they kept saying things in Spanish to make the other one laugh. And it was because a lot of the films he's made have been heavy.
Yeah.
You know, it is one of those moments where you just go, well, this is perfect.
Yeah,
the two of them up there didn't even realize there was an audience, just going to town, and it was priceless.
But I mean, what happened at that particular moment in time that these three or four, actually the four great Mexican directors, all came out of the same mm-hmm. same moment, they're triumphant, and they very much work off of each other.
They do.
Yes.
And the best thing is just to hear them cursing at each other in Spanish in a room full of people where half know exactly what they're saying, but the other half is clueless and just thinks it's all you know, it's like, ah, cabrón. It's like, cabrón. You don't just throw that one out there, guys. You don't just, it is joyful. Yeah. In the same way you're talking about Martin Scorsese, he is joyful.
Yeah.
And you watch him and he excites you. You know, you don't have, I'm not a filmmaker, but I watch him and I would do whatever he says.
If
he tells me to jump off a bridge, odds are I'm jumping off that bridge.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he just has that way.
Yeah, that's a contagious excitement.
It is
very much what you need, especially if you're working long hours and the thing, you're not quite sure what you're doing, to have that to play off of.
That energy has to be something that you draw on freely.
Exactly. Yeah.
You mentioned working with Nicole Kidman. That's a film I think is an extraordinary movie called Birth. And if you folks haven't seen Birth, you really should. It'd be better to see it in the theater, certainly, because it's a mood piece. It's very much a mood piece, but hard to describe. And you don't want to give anything away in describing it. But it's you play her fiancé.
I play her fiancé, directed by Jonathan Glazer, and I play her fiancé. And there's a boy who her husband died, and I've now been engaged to her for quite some time, and we're planning to get married. And this boy turns up and claims to be the reincarnation of her lost husband.
Yeah, and she believes him.
She does. She's desperate enough to believe him.
Yeah, fascinating film. Fascinating.
And I mean, he's my nemesis. So this little boy becomes my nemesis, which is a wonderfully awkward situation.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
That's something different. And I'm sure as an actor, fun is not, but, you know, it's something that's different for you.
Yeah.
It gives you something else to try.
Yeah.
Was it tough at all because you grew up with the people that you grew up with and watching those people? Was it ever tough sort of adjusting to newer mindsets, younger mindsets? Just because when you are around these kinds of professionals, real professionals, you know, when you see certain antics now, I think about, well, so-and-so would never have allowed that. You know, this person would never have let that go.
Well, my father was a very modern thinker. I think his work now would be just as wonderful and modern, right? Mm-hmm. And he was, I mean, the other day, I was talking about a film that Orson Welles made called The Other Side of the Wind, mm-hmm. Which my father is in, and it's zero vanity in his performance. And he plays quite a monstrous character. Mm-hmm. But the sort of bravura of these guys working together, Welles and my father, and they laughed a lot, and they enjoyed it. And they were mavericks. They liked to break the rules, and they liked to break the mold, and they liked it. They enjoyed it, and that film is just, it's insane and very modern and very, very up to date.
I think it's an avant-garde film, actually.
Yeah. It is.
Still to this, I mean, it was just unveiled to us last year.
Too modern for us to completely digest.
Yeah, exactly.
It's quite aggressive in its nature. Mm-hmm. But yeah, they were very, they were all about being maverick and breaking the rules.
Did you ever meet Orson Welles?
I did. I had the great privilege of meeting Orson Welles. And it was in a restaurant in L.A., and it was a very hot day, and Orson was eating a lot. and my father was, I could see, feeling a little queasy. but they were talking about The Other Side of the Wind, and it still wasn't completed, and he was still filming it. My father just respected him so much. And this was during, you know, a lot of the scenes that my father shot for us and was while he was making Man Who Would Be King.
Mm. Mm, oh, my.
Yeah. So he traveled back from Morocco.
Wow.
Orson, we have a photo.
Strong constitution.
In my mom's office, there's a wonderful photo of your dad and Orson.
Yeah. They're usually laughing.
They are.
I think
he's leaning over him.
Yeah.
Oh, I know the photo. Orson has this brown, looks like a caftan situation.
And of course, Orson was in, it was in my father's Moby Dick.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, you played Orson Welles.
I did.
In a movie.
I did.
I can't imagine approaching that task.
Well, it was quite a overwhelming idea for me to play Orson Welles, and one filled with reverence and respect. Mm-hmm. But then I thought, how would they feel about it? And I thought, well, I'm sure they would find it funny. Mm-hmm. And for me, and there was a sort of a little sign I got, which I probably created for myself, which was, it's okay, kid, go out, give it a try.
Don't take it too seriously.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, it's so funny, these lines that blur, in your case, because of you being a second generation person who has carved his own career, a considerable one.
Third.
But of course, third generation.
Right.
Duh. Yeah. Third generation to have carved your own niche, your own career, and yet to still have all this to draw on in your consciousness. You can't avoid it.
Well, that's what I mean. I can't imagine.
You grew up immersed in it.
Seeing those people and then being on a set today and having that as a part of you. You know, and then if someone impresses you, is it because a little part of them reminds you of someone?
Well, you know, when we talk about working with like Mike Figgis, where it was, you know, we were working with Time Code, we were working on a quadrant, and there were 90-minute takes. Each square was a 90-minute take, and the actors were writing the scenes on music paper. So that we could get our timing right as far as who would move into what square at what particular time. This sort of stuff is just, you know, really exciting for me because, no, they never did that.
Sure.
Or working with people like Simon McBurney on a play I just did about The Kid Stays in the Picture, about Robert Evans. What he did on the stage was just so innovative and breaking cinematographic rules, and having a box with different glass and shaping it in these different reckless ways. It just keeps me excited and keeps me advancing rather than thinking, oh, do they remind me of them? Or,
yeah. Now, because you are a writer and director yourself, do you have to turn off part of your brain or compartmentalize things when you are merely an actor in a movie, or do you find it easy to surrender to that and just allow the director and the screenplay to take you on that journey?
I like to think, and directors may disagree with me that I've worked with, but I like to think that I'm a collaborator and that I'll offer something up but basically I'm there to serve the story as they are, really, in essence. We're all just trying to do something that's good. But in the I don't want to bring it up too early, but with the last photograph, with the last photograph, it was quite a sort of schizophrenic experience for me because I directed and acted in it. And one of the reasons I cast myself in the last photograph was because I knew that I was available and possibly turn up on time. But it was difficult in the sense that this character is going through a lot, and having to bring that character back home was tough, but I was also directing it, and I was using all these different mediums, and it was really exciting, and it was exhilarating, and getting back in the saddle and doing what I originally intended to do, so that was a very light and kind of uplifting feeling. Mm-hmm. So I had these two sort of polar opposite experiences.
And who did you cast opposite you?
I cast Sarita Chowdhury, a young boy called Jonah King, and Stacey Martin. And it's a story about a man who loses a photograph, or maybe it's stolen, he starts to spiral. He panics in searching for it. And in the telling of the story, which is told in a series of flashbacks, sort of a collage of flashbacks, we understand what the photograph means. It's a very simple concept.
And where did you shoot?
I shot in London and in Scotland, Lockerbie. Mm-hmm. As the story progresses, we discover The man's son died on a Pan Am flight,
mm-hmm.
over Lockerbie, mm-hmm. in 1988, December 21st. Mm-hmm. And the structure of it is such that the drive between father and son to the airport is kind of like the spine of the story.
Mm-hmm.
And a conversation that maybe banal becomes more interesting and when we know what's about to happen.
Mm-hmm. When you're looking at scripts, when you're being submitted scripts as an actor, what makes you say yes, other than the prospect of a job, of course, but because you've done such a wide range of films. You played Poseidon in, mm-hmm. Clash of the Titans. You played Dr. Frankenstein in Bernard Rose's
yes.
version of the classic story. You've played.
You're in Wonder Woman.
You're in Wonder Woman
as a fabulous bad guy.
General Ludendorff.
Fabulous, yes. Bad guy.
Thank you.
Played
very
Hal
much.
Roach in Stan and Ollie. I
mean, yes, which
watch a wide range of parts. So, in pictures large and small, in scale.
Hmm.
What is it? The director? Is it your co-star? Is it the location? What is it that will
the location?
All other things being equal.
my credo really is to work with people that I respect.
Mm-hmm.
That's primary, and of course story.
Mm-hmm.
But I am looking, especially when I'm playing villains like General Ludendorff, who wants, mm-hmm. to exterminate mankind.
we've all been there.
Yes, I'm looking for a key, like Hepburn was on African Queen. I'm looking for something that just unlocks it for me, so that I understand. And Patty Jenkins is a wonderful director. She was very, very helpful to me. And General Ludendorff existed. He was real. He lost his son in the First World War. He was humiliated by what happened to Germany and he knew Hitler, but he wasn't particularly fond of Hitler. And then you just start to dig in, and you think, oh my God, and the photographs of him, he always has his sort of downturn lips that go down as if he, mm-hmm. was abused at some point in his life. And you can see the sadness. And with collaborating with Patty, we came up with a character that is not just plainly what he is fulfilling in the screenplay.
Mm-hmm. And yet there you are in one of the biggest box office, mm-hmm. Smashes of the year. No one could predict that. I mean, you might have predicted on Wonder Woman. It seemed like a surefire hit. People have lost a lot of money betting on anything in the movie business.
They certainly have.
I think about your part in Children of Men, which is such a superb movie. Again, working with Alfonso Cuarón, another of these fantastically talented Mexican emigres. Again, does he open the door for you to collaborate?
Alfonso, yes, he does, and Chivo is the cinematographer. Yes. They're great. They're a great team together, the character I played there was this sort of art curator who and it's the end of the world basically, and he's got the Statue of David in Battersea Power Station, in London. So the whole thing was just too wonderful. And I just finished playing Orson Welles in Fate to Black, Alfonso would be like, yeah, just talk about the painting, or do what you like. But Alfonso is the type of director, and a lot of people, because you now have this video village on film sets,
yes.
where everybody's sort of looking at the monitor. Nobody's really looking at the scene. But Alfonso would be sitting right next to the lens of the camera, on the dolly, and observing.
Present.
And very, very present. I remember that about my... You're talking about comparisons. Of course there are, now that we're talking. I remember my father watching a scene, and he'd make the same gesture that the actor was making, sort of Ooh. Like a kid watching a cartoon or something. You know what I mean? And the guy, and somebody would be angry, and you'd see my father was looking angry and happy, and you'd see the sadness in his face, and he was animated, and I felt that kind of participation with Alfonso.
Yeah. I mean it in a good way. It's the thing that it's what excites you, as you say. Talking about people who stage things in a way you never thought of, shooting things in a way you never thought of. That was a big part of who your dad was.
Yes.
Your family in general. Yeah. They're people who try and do different things.
Yeah. And then, I mean, but you also, they kind of don't make them like that anymore.
Well,
And you know, Lauren Bacall was just.
I can't.
You were talking about Birth. I remember Lauren Bacall. the AD, the assistant director, coming in, and side of his face was bright red. I said, "What's wrong?" He goes, "Lauren Bacall slapped me." And I said, "Why? What did you do?" He said, "Well, I took her dog, Papillon, for a walk, and apparently I was gone for too long." And he looked really upset. And I said, "Oh, come on, man! I said, you were slapped by Lauren Bacall."
If you're gonna have a red face, do you know what I mean? If you're gonna have it, that's the way.
Red is a badge of honor.
Exactly.
I would say.
Yes. Exactly.
Did you ever read your father's autobiography?
I certainly did. Well, there's an open book.
Yeah.
And then there's Larry Grobel's book, which is the Houstons. Both great works, I believe. An open book is a collection of just fantastic stories from my father's life. But we used to kid around the family. We used to say, it's anything but an open book. and Larry Grobel really opened the story of our family up much more. And it's really interesting for me because he goes back to Walter and Walter's childhood, and so it's an incredible piece of research for the family to have.
Well, he's really good. He's an excellent interviewer and biographer. Yeah.
In part, though, it is your life, and that's a bit, you know, we talk about these people as the, you know, the giants that they were, but it is your dad and your grandpa and your, you know, so there's also the human.
It's easy for me to sometimes to take umbrage and to say that's not real, or nobody should say that, you know, and defensive.
Mm-hmm.
It's
your family, though. That's you're allowed.
Right.
You know,
and everybody has a different story from a different perspective.
Yeah.
So fair enough.
Yeah.
And it creates good drama.
Yeah.
My father loved a film that was written, a book.
Peter Vertell's book?
Peter Vertell's book, White Hunter, Black Heart.
Mm-hmm.
And that depicted him as irresponsible, et cetera. And Peter Vertell, I think, asked my father, after he'd read it, if he felt okay with it being published. And my father, of course, said yes, but then later said, Peter Vertell would have published it anyway, but he quite enjoyed the depiction that Peter Vertell wrote in his portrait of my father, and these guys, Wells and my father, they knew how to live up to their own mythology.
Mm-hmm. Well, they certainly did.
Yeah,
they certainly did. Talk about larger than life. I mean, I read that book of your father's. I remember I was on jury duty in New York City and in Manhattan, and that's how I passed the time most enjoyably while I was waiting for something to happen in the courthouse. And it's so absorbing, and he's tough on himself. He doesn't paint a rose-colored picture of himself, certainly. And I found that really interesting. And I'm not sure if I would have enjoyed working for him necessarily, but I certainly, but I did enjoy hearing the story.
Mm.
You know, what did you think of Mr. Eastwood's portrayal in the movie of White Hunter, Black Heart?
I thought it was very good, and I thought the film was very good, actually. Mm-hmm. I found Eastwood's voice a little thin.
Well, yes.
Yeah.
Well, you've got your father down, of course, first off, you've inherited a wonderful speaking voice, or maybe cultivated as well. But you do an imitation of your father, almost you slip in and out of it seamlessly. and it's joyful to hear.
Thank you.
Clint Eastwood couldn't quite get that.
Yeah.
get that.
But the film works.
Yeah.
I like the film. Yeah. I like the film. Do you think your father, well, he said of the book, it's going to happen anyway, so there's no point.
I think he'd be delighted that anybody bothered. You know, you know, there was he regarded film highly, of course, but he also was quite light-hearted about it.
Mm-hmm. You work for Sofia Coppola. Speaking of family, relations and family dynasties, in Marie Antoinette, in a rather amusing role. But I don't think you've ever been so costumed or bewigged before.
Bewigged.
Yeah.
Yes, that was working with Sofia was a lot of fun, and we were in some sort of palace just outside of Paris. It wasn't Versailles; it was somewhere else.
Just a palace.
Yes.
We just found one.
Yeah, and Kirsten Dunst and the emperor. I give him tips on how to have intercourse, I believe, and I relate it to a clock and keys, how you have to put a key in a hole and turn it, etc. forgive me for that symbolic picture.
Now you laughed a moment ago when I said the word location.
Yeah.
Was there a reason? Are you thinking about a particularly awful location that you've had to suffer?
I've suffered awful locations gladly. My favorite awful one was in the middle of Australia, mm-hmm. when I made a film called The Proposition,
mm-hmm.
John Hillcoat directed, Guy Pearce and Ray Winston, and a few others. Emily Watson, and that it was just so hot, mm-hmm. and miserable and fly ridden that you really had to learn how to act with your fellow flies, and still look somewhat dangerous without going poof, poof, poof. it's a great luxury to be able to travel to places that you wouldn't go to ordinarily.
Sure.
And to experience them with people that are working that are from there, so you really mm-hmm. experience mm-hmm. The country and the people. And back to my father, I do love talking about my father far more than I do myself. He took African Queen to the Belgian Congo.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he was one of the first studio film directors who took the film to the actual location.
Mm-hmm. Even going to Mexico for Treasure of Sierra Madre, that was
exactly
not, that was not typical at that time.
No, it wasn't. Just outside of Puerto Vallarta,
mm-hmm.
I remember. And then Puerto Vallarta became very popular.
Mm-hmm.
I remember him saying, "I ruined Puerto Vallarta."
Well, I think the Night of the Iguana.
That's when you land. It says that in the airport, yeah. Just so everyone understands.
The Night of the Iguana is the one that ruined Puerto Vallarta.
Yes, Night of the Iguana, of course. And it was Richard Burton, Deborah Carr, and I think Ava was there. Yes, Ava was in the film,
mm-hmm.
And Elizabeth Taylor was visiting. So it was quite a sort of tabloidy. thing to write about.
Where did you shoot Robin Hood with Ridley Scott?
Robin Hood, I was just outside of Pinewood Studios.
And, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Legendary.
Yeah.
Not so exotic.
Yeah, legendary Pinewood Studios. Yeah. Mm-hmm. 007 stage mm-hmm. they have there, yeah. Yes, it's on Succession, which I just worked on lately.
I love that show so much.
So do I.
And you're great in it.
It's wicked.
And Cherry Jones just came in.
Oh, really?
Like, what more do you need in your life? You have all these people. Yeah. It's just...
And Jesse Armstrong, I mean, the writing in it, it's
superb.
It is, I believe, superb. We were filming in Croatia, which I've never been to before, and that was mm-hmm. that was great. I love visiting Croatia.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking forward to go back at some point. And it's not that expensive.
Mm-hmm. They film a lot there for that.
Yeah,
you know.
I walked into our bedroom, and my wife was watching Yellowstone just a few weeks ago, and I saw you get gunned down.
Yes.
So I guess you're not in Yellowstone anymore.
Nope, that's it. I fooled you at the end of the first season, where everybody thought I'd left the mm-hmm. show with a noose around my neck. Sadly now I'm gone, truly gone.
How do you keep up with all of the things you're on? Because I struggle. When my dad said that to me and he said, oh, I just watched him die in Yellowstone. I said, oh, God, I'm watching him on Succession. You know, it's like, you're a busy gentleman.
Thank you. And thank you for referring me to me as a gentleman. what happens sometimes is, I mean, for instance, the last photograph, I wrapped that 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Wow, sure.
Just sometimes it just so happens that everything comes out at once. Mm-hmm. And it looks like you've done it all at once, mm-hmm. but you haven't.
Just tell me. Oh, I'm so busy. I'm just so
I'm a very busy gentleman. Taylor Sheridan with Yellowstone, I think he's a remarkable writer. He's, the Native Americans, the old ranch landowners, and the new land developers, and those three worlds colliding mm-hmm. is just a great piece of Americana, mm-hmm. and an America that I don't particularly know. And Taylor's great at that epic sort of landscape and buffalo runs, et cetera, with mm-hmm. Kevin Costner. And Succession, yet another America, more about the viciousness in the dialogue and the sort of clever maneuvering of these rather despicable characters, but very modern day characters. And then I came out with another film called Angel Has Fallen, which is a fun kind of mm-hmm. popcorn shoot 'em up a film, which I was delighted to be with. Jerry Butler was a friend for many, many years, so it's great to see him do so well. And at the same time, I had the last photograph in one theater nationwide at the Lamley in Santa Monica. Now it's going off onto its digital platform.
And yes, people can find it online now, too.
Now.
Yes.
Yeah.
You can have it
on
now.
On VOD.
Yeah.
Now, I want to mention a show that you were on that didn't last as long as I think it deserved to. Magic City.
Yeah.
Where you got to play a gangster in Miami.
Great looking, too.
Yeah. Wonderful production design.
Yeah. I love that character, Ben Diamond. Mm-hmm. Sort of a Meyer Lansky kind mm-hmm. of character. Miami, late 50s. Mitch Glazer, the showrunner and writer, he grew up in Miami, but his father was very much in the hotel business. And mm-hmm. so the design was extremely precise and detailed. The chandeliers, everything mm-hmm. was absolutely, absolutely correct. I loved Ben Diamond. I mean, he's just, we earlier said I like to find a key into a character and understand mm-hmm. what makes them tick. Well, with Ben Diamond, I thought, well, you know what? Just play him for what he is. Mm-hmm. Don't worry about the psychology behind the guy. He's just I really enjoyed him. Maybe if you know the show or if the audience know the show or not, he's a real sort of cigar chewing. But he also has. There is a sort of weird integrity, sort of honor amongst thieves mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. that he has that was enjoyable to play, even though he's twisted beyond belief.
But you let it out.
Yes.
You know, you let out your
crazy. Is it cathartic playing a character like that in any way?
In a lot of the films, I play a lot of villains. Mm-hmm. Some of them is when you reason them out. I mean, I had a line in The Constant Gardener where the character says those patients would have died anyway, and he's talking about these people that are in Kenya that have AIDS, and they're testing pharmaceutical drugs on these people, and it was just the most hard line to comprehend how anybody mm-hmm. could actually say that. And when you start reasoning it out with the help of Le Carre and start to identify why this man would say something like that, when you can say a line like that with commitment and understanding, it's quite chilling.
Mm-hmm.
That, in a sense, is, you know, taking the scalpel out and prodding a character and seeing where they feel. And so that, mm-hmm. in a way, it's an education. You understand things that you wouldn't want to understand otherwise. Mm-hmm. The actual sword fighting and shooting a gun, and that's kind of play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it's just, that's just kind of fun.
I always think that of the good and the bad of being an actor, one of the coolest things is that you get to learn how to do different things, whether it's shooting or you're playing a doctor, or you're playing a lawyer, whatever it is. It's the idea that you get to acquire a new skill.
Yes. Yes.
And I think that's such a wonderful way to live, that someone calls you and says, all right, you have to be able to hold a gun and a flashlight realistically, so it really looks like you're a detective or a police officer, whatever it is. You know, today you're going to be a lawyer, so you really need to know your stuff and have this down pat. It's all, that's the fun bit.
It is, and to keep learning and just to keep your mind fresh and open and excited. I mean, I'd love to actually go back. I was talking to a friend of mine the other day. I'd love to go back to school and just learn for the hell of it, you know?
Yeah.
Just have fun and without any kind of commercial ambition. Mm-hmm. That sometimes when you're lucky from an acting point of view, you can sort of apply that, and that's a great luxury.
Where do you call home?
Well, kind of wherever I hang my hat.
Mm-hmm. I had that impression. That's how I asked the question. I was curious.
And whenever I go to a new country or something, I always, oh, home, maybe I could live here. I don't really have a strong sense of where it is that I'm from. I mean, our family are, I like to say, we're tinkers, you know, we're sort of gypsies, sort of nomadic. And Walter was Canadian. Irish by descent. My father was born in Missouri, Nevada, a place called Nevada in Missouri. I was born in Rome, in Italy. I grew up in Ireland as a kid, and then he moved to Mexico. And I've been in L.A. I mean, L.A. does have that sort of seasonless quality that we were talking about earlier, where you actually realize, my God, I've been here a very long time. Mm. The house that I live in at the moment is a rickety old house. It makes lots of sounds. in the Hollywood Hills. I've been there for 15, 20 years.
Mm. I got to visit your father on the set of his last movie, The Dead. Mm. We were going to interview him for Entertainment Tonight during a lunch break. They said first he's going to take a little cat nap, as is his habit, mm-hmm. and then he'll come and talk to you. And the producer, I think it was Bernd Eichinger, said, here's the story. He's on oxygen. When you start to roll the camera, he will take the oxygen tube out. And when he does, he'll be like a carp out of water. Only he won't admit it. So you will have to find an excuse to stop periodically.
Right.
And let him take some more oxygen and then continue the interview. And I turned to my director and our camera guy and I said, okay. So I would ask him a question. He would give me a well-phrased, eloquent answer. I say, you know, Mr. Houston, we need to just readjust the camera slightly. Do you mind? We just need a minute or two.
He probably thought you all were terribly unprofessional, having to stop after every question. Again? Again, you guys?
And that's how I conducted a somewhat brief but valuable interview with John Houston. And I'm so glad I had that experience.
Yeah, that was in Valencia.
In a warehouse.
Near Magic Mountain.
In a warehouse.
That's funny.
Yeah, I remember. See, he really resisted going there because it was winter was approaching, and Bray's studio in Dublin, there was some sort of union strike.
Mm-hmm.
And so it looked like he'd missed the opportunity to make The Dead. So I said to him, this is over the phone, I said to him, Dad, you know, it's mainly an interior film. You can kind of shoot it anywhere. And he said, I think that's just a god-awful idea. And literally put the phone down on me. But finally, that's what he did. And he had a second unit shooting the exteriors.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And all these wonderful Irish actors arrived, excited to be in Hollywood. And they were put in a van and driven to
Magic Santa Clarita. Beautiful Santa Clarita. Yes.
And I think the final question I asked him was, I'm going to misquote myself. Can he get a good night's sleep when he's making a movie? And he says, a better night's sleep than I can when I'm not making a movie.
Oh, that's wonderful.
I thought, well, there's John
there
Houston.
There he is, yeah. That's
there's wonderful. John Houston in a nutshell.
I remember somebody interviewing him, and they said, Mr. Houston, what do you attribute your longevity towards? And he thought about it, and he said, surgery. he had great one-liners. What was the other one? How many cigars do you smoke? As many as I can. And Mitchum had great lines like that.
Oh, too. I
in the morning, I was like, morning, Bob, how are you? Worse. You like some coffee? Makes me fart.
Oh, God.
Great guys.
He was a handful. Yeah.
So on top of this, on top of all the rest, then you played Hal Roach.
Yes.
And it's brief, but you're Hal Roach.
Yes. Now, that was a rather daunting experience for me because I used to love Laurel and Hardy.
Mm-hmm.
And I watched them a lot as a kid.
Sure.
In Italy. And they were dubbed. In Italian. And they would speak this really kind of funny Italian. It was hysterically funny. And then finally, when I saw them in English, they were still great. But it was like, well, why aren't they still talking the same way? But anyway, so I go on set. And there's Steve Coogan and John C. Reilly. And they look exactly like Laurel and Hardy.
They were perfect.
I mean, the prosthetics, the chin, the thing, the nose, the face, the manners, and everything. And I was just gobsmacked. And the camera was rolling. I was like, line, can somebody please? I'm sorry for making my line. I'm having a really weird flashback. but yeah, they were just that. What a warm performance from them
yes.
both.
Yes, indeed. I got to meet John C. Reilly ever so briefly during awards season, and I said to him, I watched Laurel and Hardy every day of my life growing up on television. And they're in my consciousness so deeply, but when I looked at the screen and saw you, all I saw was Oliver Hardy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was like a piece of alchemy.
Yeah. And those little dances they do.
Everything.
So delicate.
It was. I really was. We had the same feeling about that, not being sure if we could really watch them and not see it. First of all, the prosthetics were fantastic. They did a beautiful job with that because you weren't distracted by them.
That's right.
But holy, I mean, they're just perfect. And as I say, it's a treat to have you there, you know, playing of all people Hal Roach. And, and there too, you know, in my household, Hal Roach. Yeah. Hal Roach. So pretty darn cool.
Yeah.
That's
Danny, it's been a pleasure having you here and talking to you and spinning stories. You're the one who's spinning the stories. We're the ones who are lapping them up.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to both of you.
Thank you. Yeah. Do you engage in social media?
Oh, I just started because I have this small film. Mm-hmm. I thought I had, you know, I want to do what best I can to promote it. So I'm now on Instagram. I'm official Danny Houston, I think, is
very
what
good.
Okay,
is
good for you.
Yeah,
and then
I'm
get off of it when you want.
Yeah, yeah. well, I'm starting to actually engage and kind of like and actually there are people that write and they say things that you can't help but ignore and reply and reply. And so I'm actually enjoying it for the moment.
Well, that's good.
For the music.
I hope that continues as long as you want it to.
Thank you.
And all I can
where is it available, VOD?
Everywhere. It's available on iTunes and on Hulu, on Amazon, on YouTube, pay-per-view, et cetera.
Pay-per-view.
No excuse not to watch it.
No excuse not to watch it.
There you are.
It's a tough film to watch. It's something that, you know, I was really happy to have it screened on the big screen because a lot of effort went into the imagery. But it's also a private sort of film that you can have your own experience with alone, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Wonderful. All I can say, looking at this roster of titles that I made for my notes here for homework. Every film you're in is made better by your being there. Mm-hmm. And that's the truth. So continue, please. Keep on doing what you're doing. And we wish you Godspeed.
Thank you.
And people want to find us. They can find us on Instagram, among others, right?
You love that Instagram.
I sure do.
You are at Leonard Maltin. I'm at Jesse Maltin on Twitter and on Instagram. And you can always go to leonardmaltin.com for movie reviews and book roundups and all kinds of good stuff.
And we're now on Patreon.
Yes, which we lovingly call Maltreon. So you do that, patreon.com/maltinonmovies.
And that's how you help support us to keep doing what we're doing. If you enjoy it, we thank you very, very much. And we'll see you next week. Today's episode of Maltin on Movies is brought to you by Legion M, the world's first fan-owned entertainment company. If you love movies as much as we do, why not own a piece of them? Find out more at www.legionm.com.